one of the things that the federal government does is if they take a current practice and they will put it into their regulations as examples, et cetera, and so it's not really a change. But another thing that happens, and this is a very clear example that went and really what surfaced this whole issue because of the disconnect, the federal code did not change for travel expenses. You could take 20 cents, I believe it was, you know, for the number of miles that you had gone. And the code said reasonable. You could take a reasonable amount. And reasonable was then defined or allowed to be defined in the regulations by the commissioner, I believe it is. And then he delegates that to the IRS, and reasonable was defined from 20 cents to 20.5 cents. So if you took one interpretation that you could take and say, well, we're tied to the code didn't change. But was the intent to say, but we wanted to be tied to the 20 cents. And there's a lot of them like that. I mean, that's just one very small example. Or are you saying, no, we're going to be tied to the rules and regulations, which now defines reasonable expense to be 20.5 cents. There was, again, nothing in the statutes or the tie in the Oregon statutes that it affected that area. And so we took the interpretation that we were tied to the 20.5 cents rather than the 20 cents because reasonable did not change.
It sounds like a reasonable proposal. Any objections from the committee?
Madam Chair, a question.
Yes, Representative Hammond.
What happens if you've got a regulation that pertains to federal law that hasn't changed and federal law that has changed? If you adopt that regulation, how do you interpret the word relevant? Do you run into problems with the word relevant? I mean, well, that's the description we have. How does Section 1A, 1A sub 3 make sure you're only dealing with the updates of the relevant rules and regulations?
Representative Hanlon, we are tied to federal laws, the code, as of December 31, 82, currently.
Yes.
So unless the code changes, we would not be following any rules and regulations. If there was a change in the actual code, another tax act, for example, then we also would not be following any rules and regulations for those changes. And those are done in committee reports, et cetera. I mean, you can tell that whether they're adopting current policy, for example, at least what our research has shown that. So we would not be... Our intent is to not follow any rules and regulations that are based on code changes after December 31, in this case, 84.
So you're telling me there's never any problem with distinguishing whether an April 1985 change in the IRS's rules and regs is related to the federal law as it was 12/31/82, or related to some subsequent change in the federal statute. There's never any problem.
Representative Hanlon, I cannot say that there's never any problem. What you have is, anytime you use the words reasonable, you're going to have a change in possibly even an amount. But the code did not change. The Internal Revenue Code still said reasonable. What changed was the rules and regulations.
I have no problem with that. That isn't my question.
Okay.
My question relates to distinguishing between, you got 100% of the rules and regulations that have been adopted since January 1st, 1985. If I gave you a list of those, could you segregate those that apply to the law as it existed, 12/31/82, versus as it applied to any changes that occurred in the law after 12/31/82?
Representative Hanlon, Don Charlton has been doing our tracking. We actually had given to us a position to track those changes last time, and he's been doing that. And I'm going to defer to him because if it's a problem, he hasn't told me.
Thanks.
Representative Hallin, the way that the code or the way the regulations are published, it's rather simple for us to tell which regulations are applying to new code and which regulation is still referring back to code as it was in prior years. The regulations are annotated as to where the change relates to, and it is very simple for us to follow what those relate to.
So if there were if you had the code as of 12/31/82, okay, and then you had a section that changed by one word after 12/31/82 in the statute or the federal law, any regulation pertaining to that particular section of the code, you're not even going to look at. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Yes. That answers my question.
And as a question as to which regulations we would also know what we're tied to, the way the law is worded, many times a code is saying, here's the general law, Treasury issue regulations regarding this law as to administration and so forth. When the code refers to, in other words, says dual regulation, this would appear to tie us to that, not as opposed to just general regulations that are just coming out on unrelated codes.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Do I hear any objections to number 12?
I don't have any.
Okay. Let's go on. Hearing no objections, we'll go on to item 13, which is section 23.
Okay, the department informs me that my description in 13 is an error, so I'd like to let them do the description explanation.
Madam Chair, item 13 deals with a regulated investment company. Probably the best example of a regulated investment company is the mutual fund that we talked about earlier. I think in this area it'll help to give a little background as to how this came about. Prior to conforming to federal law, our law said that regulated investment companies would have, in essence, the same taxable income as they did for federal purposes, which in most cases was zero. When we conformed, we conformed with certain modifications, and one of these modifications, we were informed after the bill passed that it would adversely affect some of these regulated investment companies that invested in Oregon bonds. The problem being is we have a provision in our law that requires interest on U.S. bonds, or excuse me, Oregon bonds, U.S. bonds also, but Oregon bonds, to be added back and be included in Oregon taxable income. So in effect, without any other modifications, that regulated investment company would now have taxable income for Oregon. Okay, but the whole general purpose of a regulated investment company, it is a pass-through type of entity that the interest or dividends or capital gains, whatever, goes through to the shareholders and is not taxed at the corporate level so long as it is distributed. The only problem being that federal law does not address whether or not the regulated investment company is entitled to a deduction for state bond interest because it's an item that's not included in taxable income anyway, in federal taxable income. So they don't need to make a provision to allow that to be subtracted out. Well, for Oregon purposes, it is included in Oregon taxable income. And by rule, we have adopted this treatment where we have said to the extent that this regulated investment company distributes those that bond interest to the shareholders, we will allow them to subtract that out from Oregon income. So what we're looking for, I guess, is a it was an item that wasn't addressed when we conformed, and we're looking for, I guess, a policy decision here as to, you know, it, was this the intent to keep the law similar to what it was before we conformed and have a regulated investment company not be taxed for Oregon purposes?
Yes.
Hearing no objections to number 12 or number 13.
That was 13.
We will go on to number 14.
14 just deals with the definition of net operating loss and whether that state definition should be the same as federal definition, and just if there is a net operating loss carried back, the beginning date for any interest to be paid.
Yes, Representative Schoon.
First of all, this applies only to corporations. Does it?
Representative Schoon, it applies to personal income tax only.
So sections 18 and 19 in this bill just apply to personal?
The business income reported on a personal return.
Okay. So we're not making any change then to the corporate provision, which does not permit them the loss carryback.
That's right, Representative Schoon.
Okay. What's the fiscal impact then? What is the change? Or what would we be doing?
Representative Schoon, basically what we would be doing is allowing whatever loss you had on your federal return, we would be allowing that on your Oregon return. And sometimes that's going to be a greater amount again, and sometimes it's going to be a smaller amount. There was a court case called Bechtolt, I believe, about 10 years ago that required modifications for, like, state income tax, et cetera, to be made to your federal net operating loss. Before that time, we were just tied to the federal loss. And what this would do is, again, restate that we wanted to allow the federal loss amounts without any modifications, including those things like ACRS type situations. For the most part, the net operating loss that you get on an Oregon return after we have to make the modifications because of the Bechtolt case, you get a larger net operating loss than you do for federal purposes. So you have a larger amount for Oregon purposes to carry back, but that can go both ways.
Very true. It also goes both ways, carry back and forward, too.
Yes, it does.
Okay.
My tea leaves tell me we're okay on the
roof. We are.
Okay.
What's the fiscal impact on this? Steve. What's the fiscal impact?
I don't know. There's pluses and minuses. And I have no idea which side it would come out on, or the magnitude. I would not expect it to be a large amount.
Would this primarily be a subchapter S corporation type on a personal return?
Representative Hugo, you mean the loss type situation?
Yeah.
No, this could be on any type of business.
Okay. Well, I'm Chairman.
Representative Schoon and then Representative Hanlon, I believe.
Is there any problem using the Oregon amount rather than the FEND?
What we found is because of the disconnect that is getting more and more complicated of the computation, and we have currently, the last biennium, I have had to send out auditors to do special training sessions just in net operating losses because of the differences. And it's for that reason it was more of a simplification that we're coming as a policy decision to change.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair.
Yes, Representative Henry.
It seems to me that that the fiscal impact is minimal at most and may even be positive to the state. I buy the CPA's line 100% here. Where we're getting overly complicated, let's tie to the feds on a provision like this.
Good point. Is there any objections? Being no objections to number 14, we'll go to number 15.
Number 15 deals with a window period that existed in the law before the 83 reconnect date for using Internal Revenue Code 338 treatment for qualified stock purchases. And again, the department can give you a more detailed explanation on what's going on here in that window period.
Madam Chair, with regard to, well, once again, maybe it would help to go over what a 338 transaction is. Situation where one corporation purchases at least 80% of another corporation, and under the special provisions of IRC Section 338, they can elect to have the target corporation, that's the corporation that has been purchased, treat it as if that corporation had sold its assets and bought them back on the same day, in effect, to get a stepped-up basis. We have adopted this treatment by adopting federal taxable income, but it only applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1 of 83. Now, the Section 338 went into effect for transactions taking place on or after August 31 of 82. We've got a four-month period there where the treatment for Oregon and federal would be different. And what this provision would do would go back and in effect eliminate that window period and make us consistent with federal in all cases. I might mention that there are also, I'm not sure whether these amendments have, I think these amendments have been presented. There's another side to this coin other than the basis. There is a certain amount of income that is required to be picked up by that target corporation for items such as depreciation recapture, items that we wouldn't pick up unless we included it with this. So our amendments will pick up the income side of the transaction as well as the difference in as well as the basis side.
It sounds like it would simplify the process.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hugo?
Well, the amendment simply picks up 21B
mm-hmm.
and is incorporated in this chapter by reference and made a part thereof. Is that the amendment you're referring to? I don't see.
Representative Hugo, the amendments I'm talking about start on line 5 of this. It says on page 12, line 39, after section 21B, insert 1.
Okay. What's the heading of the amendment?
Hmm? Elizabeth Stockdale, March 13th.
Okay. Representative Hugo, yes, those are the amendments. Those have been presented by Don McNeil. There are some additional amendments that need to be made to that amendment.
All right.
But generally, those were introduced by Don McNeil, okay, as you have them.
And you're tying 338C1 of the IRC. And then you're making it part of the chapter by reference.
Representative Hugo, that's correct. 338C1 is the section that deals, I think, deals with the gain. Okay. And the amendment, well, says that we shall recognize the gain or loss pursuant to the method prescribed in 338C1.
Okay. What other amendments do you need on that? Do you need to amend that section further?
No, not okay. That section.
Madam Chairman.
Representative Scott.
We'll have a chance to look at the amendments, right?
Under here.
I just have to add a little something here. I have a note from the Dalles Area Chamber of Commerce. They voted in favor of House Bill 2011 by 7, opposed 2, and undecided 4. And I think the undecided 4 are probably the only honest ones because I doubt it. The Dalles Chamber of Commerce.
Aren't they a kick?
I just love them. 7-2, undecided 4. And I want to know who the 4 were because I think they're the only honest ones. Unless we have 7 CPAs. Anyway.
Madam Chair,
who said
can we correspond with the Dallas Chamber of Commerce and ask God that when they submit those that
each of their members submit a written statement of the rationale underlying their vote?
They'll probably do it. I just had to add that. Is there any objections to Section 21B? That seems a little bit more appropriate than saying number 15.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Representative Hanlon.
Is there any simple, through the department or our staff, is there any simple way of telling us exactly what we're doing in adopting number 15? In ordinary street language?
I suppose, Representative Hanlon, what you would be adopting is there would be some corporations that would be using this treatment that came into the federal treatment before the December 1, 83 tie. But we would probably find that very difficult to find in an audit situation where they treated it differently. And it's for one of those reasons that we brought this, because they probably, we had a couple of calls which brought it to our attention that they had this window pier, and we knew about it, but there was some concern out there. And the dollar impact that we were told at that point was about $5,000 estimate, so it looked like it would be small. And something like that is just going to be very difficult to find that in an audit situation.
Madam Chair, can I follow up?
Yes.
Berlina, are you saying that if we adopt this and lose $5,000, we might be better off than spending an extra $5,000 sending your auditors all over the territory?
But Representative Hanlon, that's true. We would probably only find it in the course of a regular audit. There would be really no way to target an audit for that type of situation.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Hanlon.
I think we're simply closing the window from August 31, 82 to January 1, 83. Is that right?
August 31, 82, I believe, and then we tied as of the end of that date, December 31, 82.
So we're closing a three-month or four-month window.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Good proposal.
Should pass.
Hearing no objections to Section 21B, we will go on to Section...
The easy one.
The easy one.
We could spend a whole day on this thing.
I presume there is some sentiment for connecting with ACRS. Is that a presumption on my part?
Yes, Madam Chair.
That's a presumption on my part. Let's have some discussion.
Can I interject a couple of things first?
Mm-hmm.
Current law is that there will be ACRS for 1985 and following years if nothing is done. Okay. And it will apply to property placed in service on or after January 1, 1985. So if that's basically the reconnect date for ACRS that's in the bill.
Tell me what the date is in the bill.
Placed in service on or after January 1, 1985.
Okay.
All right, that could be two separate decisions, whether to have ACRS or not, and then if so, when it would first take place in terms of property placed in service. Secondly, whether the tax year affected for the taxpayer would be the tax year ending after that date placed in service or beginning or before the date placed in service, and then how you want to whether ACRS would just apply to new property that placed in service after the connect date, or whether there would be some kind of tie to the ACRS for old property placed in service prior to the reconnect date.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Hanlon?
If we continue our present depreciation or recovery law, let me say that again differently. If we don't go to the federal method and we can and we adopt what we have done for tax years 1984 and before, what will be the difference in revenue versus if we adopted the ACRS package as of 1/1/85?
Okay, if assuming that we do not have ACRS continue 84 treatment forward in 85 and 86, there would be a revenue gain of $38 million is the current estimate for personal and corporate. So under current law, with having ACRS in 85 and forward, you are looking at approximately $38 million less revenue than what is potentially possible if without ACRS for the biennium.
Thank you.
Say it again, $38
million. Right, you'll have, under current law, you'll have ACRS. That will cause a reduction in revenue of about $38 million compared to what you would have without ACRS.
That would assume, that $38 million assumes if we adopted it, ACRS, it would, the date placed in service would be 1/1/85 or after.
Yes.
The tax year effective would be 85. It would apply to both new and old property.
New only.
New only. Okay.
New meaning placed in service after the connect date.
With 38 million, we're talking about new property.
Yes.
And if we were to somehow, I'm not suggesting this, but if we were somehow trying to pick up the old property, say over a couple of years or a couple of bienniums, what would that cost?
It's not that old, is it? A couple of bienniums?
No. I said it bad. I didn't see it.
Okay. If you tried to basically switch from the current depreciation schedule for property placed in service prior to 85, old property, to an ACRS schedule, and did not try to go back and make up prior differences, but just the current year difference, you're looking at a figure of about an additional $55 million is my best number right now.
An additional 55.
In addition to the 38?
Yes.
So if we went back to start at the beginning of the when the Fed started ACRS, we would have a loss of 55 plus 38.
No, if you started out with ACRS for all new property, 85, 86, right, and in 85, 86, you also took existing property and switched it from the current depreciation schedule to the ACRS schedule for that year.
Yeah. This taxable year?
Yes, 85 and 86.
Okay.
Then you're looking at an additional $55 million change in revenue. Or if you tried to go back and do it for all prior years.
I'm nervous.
For $93 million total.
Right. All prior years would be above that.
All prior years would be in addition to $93 million revenue loss. If you went back to when the Fed started ACRS, and probably a substantial addition.
If you try to make up for all of those differences right now, immediately up front in 85.
Or allow people to go back and amend, the net effect would be the same.
Yes. Now, I've also tried to come up with a rough estimate of what it would be, whether it's a tax year ending or tax year beginning. And as far as I can see right now, you're looking at maybe an additional $1 to $2 million reduction if it's tax year ending rather than beginning.
Madam Chair, discussion on this point. Why do we want to adopt the federal method when it costs us almost $40 million?
Because when the governor has budgeted $60 million for this bill, and I thought what I would like to see is as much conformity and as much simplicity as we can garner. And I think probably there's been more discussion about this than almost any other issue since the federal code was adopted. I would hope that we would adopt this with our own unique quirks, for lack of a better word. I guess I'm not even sure how to discuss it because I just, in my mind, you know, it was happening. And so I don't have any really good arguments. I would like to see conformity and I would like to see simplicity.
Madam Chair, I agree with conformity and